This is a Geek Leader Podcast, and I'm your host, John Rauta. This show is all about helping us grow as leaders, become better technologists, and improve our lives both at work and at home. I hope you enjoy the show and learn a lot. Hello, world, and welcome to Geek Leader Podcast. I'm your host, John Rauta, and this is episode 197. And today's sponsor is Private Internet Access. If you've ever surfed the web and wanted to do it securely, especially when you're traveling or using someone else's network, you definitely need private internet access. Private internet access allows you to have a secure VPN without them logging what data you're doing, what transactions you're making, or anything like that, to connect to anywhere in the world. You can also change your default location so it appears as if you're coming from a different place. Why is this helpful, you say? If you're not doing anything nefarious, well, it's really helpful if you want to test DNS resolution from different places and different time zones. It's a really cool tool, and it's not very expensive at all. You can get plans starting at $3.99 a month, and you can find out more by going to ageekleader.com/VPN. Again, that's ageekleader.com/VPN. All right, Geek Leaders, today on the show, I've got Andrew Bartlow, and he's got 25 years of experience in human resources and talent management. He's also the leader of Series B Consultant, which helps businesses grow and scale up, and the co-author of a book called Scaling for Success. And we're going to talk a lot about leadership, management, how to scale yourself and your team and your business today. With all that being said, Andrew, welcome to the show.
John, thanks a lot. Really great to be here.
If you don't mind, just to lay some context for our conversation, tell the audience a little bit about how you got to where you are and what you're doing today.
Sure. Well, you mentioned it. A lot of years as an in-house human resources leader, companies large and small, from Fortune 50 to less than 50 employees, right out of grad school. And yeah, I got lucky. I was the chief HR officer of a company that went public on my watch, and had a little tiny piece of what is now Invitation Homes, a real estate tech company. And so with an exit out of there about 4 years ago, I started consulting, wrote my bucket list book, really trying to help other companies and other human resources leader, be fortunate the way that I was, do things a little better with a few less mistakes along the way. So that's where the book came from, and that's where the consulting project came from. And I also started a program focused on executive education for HR leaders as well, called People Leader Accelerator. So it's been a lot of fun, been a great ride.
So one question that I have that I get some feedback on and some questions on when I'm talking to people is, what is HR's role in leadership development? Because I've been at a company before where HR's role was, you need to teach yourself leadership. We're just here to, protect our employees and protect the business, more or less. Mm-hmm. And then I've had other roles where where HR takes a strong stance and said, we're going to offer all these leadership developments. We're going to work to build our team and grow them up. What is your take on all that?
Yeah, it's it varies. It varies company to company, and it should. It depends. Mm-hmm. What it should not depend on is what that HR leader prefers. What it should depend on is what the company really needs, given where they're at and size and stage and, dependence on, their workers versus physical assets, et cetera. And so, is there a clear cut right and wrong answer for do it in-house versus outsource, do a lot of it versus do a little of it? The answer is more nuanced. It's around, use your critical thinking to figure out, is this really needed at the organization? To what extent, to what depth? Are we positioned to do it really well inside, or are we trying to do some bare minimum and get some scalability out of it? So, it's not a straightforward answer, but those are some of the frameworks that you would use to decide how much of it and who does it.
Mm, yeah, for sure. I know one thing that caught my eye when I was reading your bio and going through your book is you talk about scaling for success. And when I first became a manager, I was very hands-on. Had to, put my fingerprints on everything, it seemed like. And, and I had a mentor one time just tell me that, what are you doing? Your team can never scale if you're like that, because you are not scalable. If you have to touch everything and be a part of everything, you're not going to be able to grow. And that was one of the hardest things that I had to do as a leader. What kind of advice would you have for someone who's in that same role as a new manager, a new team lead?
Yeah, well, hey, first, congratulations, right? That means that you've reached a new level of success where you have new and different types of challenges. And now, instead of being the super high performing individual contributor or the visionary that got your business off the ground, you know, now you're in the, you know, sometimes difficult situation of managing people and trying to ensure that people are doing the same things that you would be doing if you were doing the work. And that's just fundamentally different work. You know, Marshall Goldsmith wrote a famous book, you know, called something along the lines of, you know, what got you here won't take you there.
Yep.
And that's so true. It's a role change from superstar individual contributor to manager of a small group of people to leader of a much larger organization. And the work is fundamentally different. And so I might suggest a framework of know, willing, and able. So it starts with awareness. That's the know. Be aware that the work is different. You know, second is willing. Do you really want to lead others, manage others, set up frameworks where other people can be successful? Or do you see your highest and best role and where you get the most energy and add the most value in doing it yourself? You have to be willing to wear the hat for the job that you're in. And then able, there's a lot that you can do to build up your skills and practice and, you know, work with great mentors and advisors to build up your skills. But that willing piece is often the roadblock for a lot of CEO founders, a lot of folks that have scaled quickly.
Yeah, I actually met a guy at a conference not too long ago that was the CTO of a company that he founded, and he basically wasn't willing to scale at that point. So he hired a CEO to do that for him so that he could, you know, get back into the product development type, you know, coding role of this tech company that he was starting up. Do you see that happening often, or is that a rarity?
I'd say that's more the exception than the rule. You know, kudos to that founder for finding someone that, you know, is willing to lead the organization, has deeper skills there. Where I've seen that happen, there's often a risk of that founder then stepping in and overruling the CEO. Hey, this is still my company. I still have control. And so they, you know, that can be a difficult situation if that founder finds themselves still trying to steer the ship in a way that undercuts the CEO that they've hired. So, you know, again, it's not easy, but that's a great move by that founder and trying to find the role where they can add the most value and be the happiest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was one of those things where the guy realized that I'm a little over my head when it comes to some of this stuff. I don't like running a business. I just like I like to write cool stuff. I like to write cool code. I like to code. You know, that's what I want to do. I want to make cool products. So I'm stepping away from doing that. And he had a cool company. They did augmented reality coding. So they were growing to the point where they were getting involved with hospitals and testing out different kind of, you know, software for future training of surgeons and things like that, where they could use their real hands and, you know, not actually, you know, do everything, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality and not really affecting patients. And it was pretty cool to see how they, you know, transitioned away from that. I need to get him on the podcast to talk about it. Probably a pretty cool little episode.
Yeah, John, what I see more often, rather than a founder hiring a CEO who's not themselves to lead the organization, I see them surrounding themselves with, you know, an HR leader or department heads or a COO who they then ask, hey, manage the people for me, manage the business, and then I can focus on being the visionary, and I can focus on the technology and the CEO seat. And that's that again, you know, comes with a lot of risk. And if the leader of the organization isn't driving the people management principles and practices, if they're halfway delegating that, that's really tricky. That's really tricky.
Yeah. I think it's halfway is always rough, because I feel like you never, it's almost better to not do it at all.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Yeah. So what are some tools or techniques or things that leaders can do? Let's say that they are willing, they are able, they do know how to do it, and they're going to get into it. What are some tools and techniques that they can have to kind of scale their team, their business, their group? Whether it's, you know, you're a middle manager and you want to scale the activities that you're doing because you're growing, your business is growing, which is something we all want to do. Or if you're the leader of the whole company, your founder, your co-founder, and you guys are growing too. What are some tools and tricks and techniques that you guys talk about and teach?
Yeah, sure. Well, I wrote about this extensively in the book that you mentioned. Thanks for the plug, Scaling for Success. You know, three big themes to help high growth companies, you know, sort out how to manage a workforce. And it starts with having a plan. You know, just because you're a startup or changing rapidly or growing quickly doesn't relieve you from the responsibility of having a plan. You're going to update that plan. It's going to change. But if you don't have a plan, it's really difficult to organize and align other people around a common goal. Yeah. So have a plan, write it down. Doesn't need to be a, you know, 30-page investor deck. Chances are you already have one of those if you've raised funding, but have a plan. You know, second piece would be, you know, keep it simple. You know, master only the basics. I see, you know, so many startups and so many founders get caught up in the flavor of the month or keeping up with the Joneses, or, you know, I read this HBR article and I want to do the same thing. You know, the fundamentals are so important to get right and invest in. And it's not exciting. It's not interesting. It's not something that you get great publicity for. But that's the bedrock of a well-functioning organization is have some of those basics, like what are people's goals and how will you communicate inside the organization? And do you have a decent health benefits plan before you start looking at, you know, sabbaticals and, you know, really fringe types of offerings? Third piece is value the context of your organization over the content of any sort of best practice you might pick up outside. So this is a little bit about the basics and the fundamentals. It's understand what'll work for you. Don't assume that whatever you read about or heard about, you can just lift and shift and drop into your organization. So use your critical thinking. If Google is doing something, chances are it will work differently, if at all, inside your much, much smaller organization that doesn't have the maturity, it doesn't have the people that have been managers for X number of years. So just be aware of your environment over trying to plug something in that somebody else says works. You need to think it through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely one of the traps that I've seen people fall into. They're like, oh, well, Google does, you know, 20% time. We should do 20% time too. I'm like, well, yeah, but you're, you know, a call center. It's a little bit different. There's certain things that, you know, you can do and you can't do, and you need to think about it and see how it works in real life, not just in theory.
Yeah, another example that's, you know, somewhat well known is Zappos, the online shoe store. They implemented a management process called Holacracy, which basically meant flat organization, self-managed work teams. You know, nobody has a manager. That ended up blowing up in a number of ways, but was, you know, got a lot of press and was really interesting. And I worked for a CEO at one point who wanted to implement Holacracy because it sounded great and, you know, interesting. And boy, let's think about how our organization with 35 different rooftops and 85 different types of jobs might be different than Zappos, mm-hmm. which was all under one roof in Vegas. Was dominated by call center agents that had very objective metrics that they could measure. It was a very different type of workforce. You know, setting aside whether Holacracy is interesting or it works under the right conditions, we were in a very different condition. And so that's where it goes to. You know, think about what works for you might be different than what works for somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even with COVID, we've had, you know, lots of people go through that same thing. I know, a lot of companies went straight work from home 100%. And then there were some companies, like especially when you get into media, where you're dealing with like extremely large files that you have to have large bandwidth, like video editing and things like that. And like, well, we really can't do that from home because people don't have, you know, that quite, you know, that much bandwidth and that much processing power to do remotely. You've got to have studios, you've got to have environments. So how do we make that happen? And realize yep. that, yeah, we are shifting to an environment where a lot of people work from home, but not everybody can yet, you know, so
that's
we
right.
can't implement that across the board.
That's right. Well, and different companies have different margins and have different needs for collaboration. So you're just going to have some different solutions. Doesn't mean that everything has to be perfectly unique to you. That's another trap of its own, right? You know, assuming that we're a special snowflake and there's absolutely nothing that could be carried over. We've got to recreate everything, which might go back to your original question around leadership training. That's a trap where a number of startups believe that they're so special that we need to create everything in-house.
Like, yeah.
Why do we need a applicant tracking system? We can build that ourselves. Why would we buy training from somebody else? We should build that ourselves. And you know, of course, that's not necessarily the right answer either.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, if someone else has perfected the wheel, just you use what they built. You know?
That's right.
Don't try to rebuild it. And that is a trap that you fall into, especially tech companies, because you know, you're coders, you can write the software to do that. You know, you look at the software and you see all the problems with it and you say, oh, I can fix that, I can write that better. But you don't realize all the iterations that they've gone through to get there. You know, yep. and you're going to have to redo all that. You're going to have to go through all the little gotchas, the things that you didn't think about because you're not an expert in, you know, a payroll. If you're writing your own payroll system or whatever, you know, you're not an expert in taxes or whatever. You're going to miss something along the way. And it's much better to, you know, build versus buy is always a complicated thing when it comes to the tech. But for the most part, when you're looking at, you know, repeatable systems that every company uses, buys is most often the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to go fast, generally, if you want to go lower cost, buy is typically the better path. Yeah. Just again, use your critical thinking. And I think that too often ego or trying to be different or being caught up in the hubris of being a, you know, startup and a visionary, you don't have to do everything yourself. You know, just be thoughtful about what will prepare you, propel you forward. And that's not always, you know, doing it on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to the having a plan.
Yeah.
So when I think of having a plan, you know, my mind goes back to project management classes where you write all these long project statements and, you know, you write out these long project plans, but in reality, a lot of that stuff isn't, it's fluff when you're a startup, when you are moving fast, when you are, trying to figure out what your product is. And, you know, that's where one of the advantages I think of Scrum comes in, because you don't really need a big, thick project plan. You just need a direction and a strategy. What are some other tools that you've seen that help people when it comes to having that plan and some of the strategic decisions that they need to make?
Yeah. Well, so much is around clarity and simplicity. What are the 3, 4, maybe 5 things on the outside that you're going to try to accomplish as an organization? You know, where will your focus be? Yeah. So as you think about trying to find product market fit or trying to get funding, or you know, what are you really working on right now? What's your plan? Write that down so you're holding yourself accountable for it and so that you are offering clarity to the rest of the people on your team. And that allows them to make prioritization decisions and resource allocation decisions and you know, helps keep your team organized. So it's really about simplicity and clarity. What's important to us right now? Patrick Lencioni is the author of all sorts of books, 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, The Advantage. You know, he doesn't have the best research-based scientific stuff, but he does talk in really practical terms in a way that connects with people. And, you know, he talks about the 6 questions for clarity. You know, who are we? What are we trying to accomplish? Who will do what? You know, those clarity questions are just so essential. And again, you don't need a 30-page PowerPoint deck. You know, what's often more valuable are your 3 bullets around what's important to the company, and maybe do that again at a department or functional level. Hey, what's important to our tech team right now? What's important to our sales team right now? And be ready to refresh that periodically as things change.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I know you've talked about on other platforms is OKRs.
Yep.
And being in tech, I've seen an uptick in presentations at conferences and virtual conferences about OKRs and the importance of strategy when it comes to OKRs. What is an OKR? What are OKRs for people that are new and don't understand what this is? And in what is the purpose?
Sure. Well, OKR stands for objectives and key results. And the history of OKRs, Andy Grove popularized them at Intel back in the 1970s. And so they were a way for work teams to identify what they were working on, what they were trying to accomplish, you know, what are our goals, are we meeting them or missing them? And he had a lot of rules that they applied at Intel that have since been carried forward, you know, largely into the tech and, interestingly, startup space, around setting stretch goals and measuring percent attainment. And I'm seeing so many organizations use these at an individual level, you know, so OKRs by person with quarterly updates. And so that's how they're often used. That's a little bit of the history. My perspective on them is that it is massively misapplied. You know, the startups and, you know, companies that are going through rapid change, OKRs, as Intel used them when they already had 10,000 plus employees in the 1970s, mature organization, OKRs are often one of those best practices that's probably not best for a high growth, high change organization. Massively misapplied, hugely detrimental to applying them in the way that, you know, many organizations are in a startup context.
So, you know, I was talking to someone this past weekend about OKRs, and they were complaining about them. Let's just be real.
Yeah.
And they're a company that, you know, they were a startup. They've had some massive growth, including an IPO probably 7 or 8 years ago. And now they're in the phase where, you know, they've gotten to, you know, chief strategy officer level. They've hired, you know, multiple layers there, and they're trying to figure out how they can continue their success. And OKRs was one of those ways, and they implemented it probably 1 or 2 years ago. And they do it the way you're talking about, where it's individual levels, where,
yep.
But they roll up to a team OKR as well.
Right.
And this past year, they had some, they did a survey, they had a consultant come in to see how their strategy was developing, how people were liking it, how they were using it. And overwhelmingly, the staff, the individual contributors, and the first level managers were negative to the impact of OKRs. They felt like it was just adding a layer of extra work to them and preventing them from actually being able to do the things that are important. Have you seen that? And what are some of the ways that companies can maybe fix this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just such enormous overhead and an incredibly administrative, bureaucratic exercise to try to, you know, get OKRs down to an individual level and write them well and be thoughtful about what they should be. And most organizations don't have the time, and maybe even more impactful, don't have the stability, the consistency of goals and priorities to write an OKR at an individual level. And let's be honest, most work is really done by teams, through collaboration. And so what are you independently and individually really responsible for and able to deliver? I think it's flawed. I think it's just fundamentally flawed that OKRs are written at an individual level the way that work gets done today.
Let me interrupt real quick, because that's also like when I think about it, a lot of tech teams are cross-functional teams, to where, you know, they have somebody from project management on a team, they have somebody from quality assurance on the team, somebody from DevOps, somebody that's a coder or whatever, developer, and they're all on a team together, but they report to different managers, and their OKRs roll up to their managers, which have an OKR for their group, but not necessarily for that cross-functional team that's actually doing the work together.
Right.
Now, is that a problem?
Sure it is. Yeah, OKRs are often the result of a overcorrection. As companies grow and they get more complicated, you worry as the leader around, hey, are we working on the right things? We're missing deadlines. I don't know what everybody's doing at any given time. And so it becomes a control measure by leadership to try to ensure that alignment is happening, to ensure that people are working on the stuff they want them to be working on, and provide some statusing against that. So it's a massive overcorrection to a legitimate issue, right? Lots of startups are still chaotic and priorities are changing. And, you know, of course, that's tough. But you miss the goal line by going leagues, you know, miles past it. Rather, I'd suggest that organizations would get a much bigger bang for the buck and really get a positive benefit versus the administrative overhead of writing individual goals and updating them, you know, quarterly, et cetera. Just write really good and simple company level goals. Mm-hmm. What are the three things that are most important to your company right now? Maybe do that at a department or functional level if you have, or team level if you have significantly sized organizations, you know, under the company. Get really good at the company level, spend some time at the department or functional level, and then the individual work, drive that through manager one-on-ones and feedback. You know, lots of organizations, it's interesting, they're doing these OKRs, which you take so much time and you end up doing it badly. Everybody's throwing out performance reviews nowadays too, right? So it's counterproductive. So have the one-on-ones, get some check-ins happening between managers and the people that work with them. And that's the better way, I think, you know, personally and professionally, having done this for a really long time, to ensure that people are on track and they're getting the course corrections that they need. It's just a lot more useful.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that as one-on-ones and check-ins and things like that and performance reviews. Cause I've got some, you know, I've had some good and bad experiences with all the above. So, yeah. We'll just dig into it. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I've been in a company where performance reviews, directly impact, compensation.
Yeah.
And not only that, I've been at, you know, a place where you have, let's say you have, 5 employees. And the medium score is a 3. So you have like a, you can give someone a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. I've seen rules where if one person's getting a 4, then someone else has to be getting a 2, you know, something like that.
Yeah. And,
you know, as a manager, and at the time I was leading a really productive team, I felt like like that was not fair at all or even possible because people are all exceeding my expectations, which is what a 3 was, you know, expectations. Yeah. So, and then I've been at another company where you can give people whatever you want. And some teams are just throwing out like everybody in the team gets a 5. And it also, you know, goes to compensation. So that was another problem. And I've also been at a third company. Let's go to this last one where nobody even reads performance reviews. You can put whatever you want in them. It doesn't affect salary in any way whatsoever. It doesn't affect anything except for that. If you want to fire someone and they've been getting 4s, then you have a problem, you know? Yep. But outside of if the person's not in trouble, nobody ever looks at them. And I've even seen a manager, I'm not going to say it was me, but a manager who in the comment section just says, I don't even know why I'm writing comments because no one reads this. And of course, no one from HR read it and responded to me or to the manager that did this. So what is the best way to do performance reviews? And are they a thing of the past? Are they something that's still important? Or should they be replaced with just like a weekly or biweekly one-on-one?
Yeah, I think you really cut to the chase with the end of that question. Yeah, the regular one-on-one will accomplish the primary goal of a performance review, which is help people improve their performance.
Yeah.
Help improve the performance of that team. That's the biggest and best, maybe not the biggest, but that's the best investment of time that you can do as an organization is ensure that one-on-ones are happening and help managers have more effective one-on-ones. You know, performance review, that's why lots of companies are getting rid of them because they're a waste of time. They're counterproductive. They burn your time. They upset people. They've become largely an administrative exercise to help you figure out who needs to get laid off when times are tough. How do you allocate a fixed pie financial budget for cost increases year over year? And the administrative exercise of that is not super value added. If the core value is help your organization perform better, that is best dealt with between the manager and the person that works with them. And so invest there and go lighter mm-hmm. on the administrative exercise of rating and ranking and distributions and grids to allocate payouts. And, you know, most of that, that's done, and boy, I've done it a thousand different ways, and I've led it as the human resources leader at companies large and small. Most of the work is just about budget allocation. And it might be well intended to have a performance review and spend a lot of time, or in some cases very little, writing thoughtful comments to try to help somebody. But a regular conversation, more frequent, less formal, mm-hmm. Is more helpful for the people doing the work and their immediate managers.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And you know, I'm pro one-on-one. I don't do them as good as I'd like to. I always find, I don't know, I'm self-critical sometimes, but I find flaws when I finish a one-on-one. Sometimes I'm like, oh man, why didn't I, you know, do this? But the good thing about it is if you have a good relationship with your team, you can just get up and walk over there and say, hey, I meant to ask you this while we're doing our one-on-one and I forgot. Some of the tips that I found that hopefully were helpful for other people is try to take perspective from the person you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And for me, I try to put myself in that person's shoes. Like I try to think of what was their morning like? How did they get to work? What was the commute like? What was, if you're not working from home, what's their family environment like right now? You know, what do I know about this? And obviously you don't know everything, but if you can get a little bit closer to their perspective, it makes you a little bit easier to communicate and talk. Also, I found that before COVID, doing walking one-on-one, so we'd go outside and walk around a pond, it kind of puts you in a neutral environment. So people aren't coming into your office, you know, and are less intimidated, I think, that way, and more free to, you know, open up and talk.
Yeah. It sounds like you're talking about empathy.
Yeah. 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 I kind of suck at empathy, so I'm trying to be better at it.
Well, hey, what, awareness or no is the first part of that. And then the willing and able, you can work through, but, how do you have an effective one-on-one? That's right. You know, try to be helpful to the person that you're working with. At high growth companies and at startups and, you know, in the tech world, you see a lot of people in their first ever manager job.
Yeah.
And a lot of managers at the same company that are in their first ever management job. You don't have the benefit of being a General Electric or a Procter & Gamble or whoever that have had people that have come up through the ranks and have received tons of formalized training. And there are lots of great role models in the organization that they can look to. It's often, you know, much more independent, much more risky, where, you know, everybody's trying to figure it out at the same time. So that's one of the more valuable areas that you can invest in as a high growth org. Back to your first question around leadership training is manager skill building, helping managers figure out how to do decent one-on-ones. That's a super highly leveraged investment in most cases.
Yeah. I think, so one question that I have is documentation. So I've talked to HR folks about this before, and they say, well, one of the important things of the, you know, performance review and the annual review is to have that documentation.
Yep.
That you've documented, that you've, you know, addressed issues, that you've talked about things, that you brought things up. And then a lot of times in a one-on-ones, we don't document anything. You know, we're just having that conversation. How do you put those two together?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the HR folks, you know, sadly are often more focused in the liability and risk mitigation element, mm-hmm. of you need to document, because if we fire this person, then we may need to defend it, or we could have an employment or legal issue. Now look at that in the grand scope of things. What percentage of people are ever fired? Even in a high growth, high change environment, it's a really low number. It's, right. You know, call it 2% of an organization is involuntarily terminated. I'm not talking about like COVID related layoffs. I'm talking about performance related terminations. It's a really low percentage of people at most organizations. I'd be shocked if anybody could really validate for me that any company does more than 10%, even Netflix. Nobody's doing more than 10% in most cases, involuntary terminations decided by the employer. So think about all the administrative and bureaucratic overhead and hurt feelings and lost productivity based around doing this documentation. You know, it's not a great use of time. It's not valuable. It's counterproductive. I would suggest that a better way to apply it is do your one-on-ones and keep one-on-one notes for everybody and have a really simple things are on track or things are off track, like a like a checkbox or a selector in your notes. I've done this in Google Docs, and you just have a running list as you talk to somebody every week or every couple of weeks, and just keep your notes there. There are technology tools that'll help you with it. You don't need to pay for those. You know, just keep track of your notes from the one-on-one and ensure those are shared with the person that works for you. A decent role of upper management or of HR is to inspect what they expect. So, you know, check to make sure that one-on-ones are happening. You can do that through a simple survey format. You know, when's the last time you had a one-on-one with your manager? My manager has one-on-ones with me at least every month. It's a really simple sort of accountability metric. And then, you know, as an HR department, you can think through, you know, what's a good way to make sure that managers are keeping track of the notes from those discussions. If documentation is just started when somebody's already in trouble, it's such a high threshold. Their decision's already made. They're just looking for the excuse to fire that person. It's just really unhealthy. So yeah. Do one-on-ones, keep some notes. It's a lot more useful to inspect what you expect around ensuring that stuff happens.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think I've been in, you know, on that side to where, you know, we want to get rid of this person, but we don't have, you know, any documentation yet, you know, because right. Maybe it's because of a behavior change. Maybe it's because, you know, who knows why, but there's no documentation. And do we want to go through the process of, you know, a written or a verbal, or you put them on a PIP? You know, what is the whole process that you want to go through with that? And I think, like you said, having the documentation ahead of time before someone's in trouble, then you can see a trend. You can see, conversations that have happened and what's happened. And for me, that's where I struggle the most with, you know, is going back and doing that documentation, because most of my one-on-ones are either outside or, you know, not in front of a computer, because, you know, I want to make it more about the person. So I try to shut the laptop, get away from the screen, talk, and then having to, you know, take the time to go back and do it. I'll be honest with you. I fall short in my documentation of one-on-ones for sure.
Yeah. That's fair. It's if you're not in front of the computer, and in today's remote environment, you know, chances are you're more likely to be in front of the computer. Right. I do like a shared doc. I do like, even if I'm knee to knee with somebody in person, you know, going through an update, I'll be in a shared doc, you know, taking some notes. And I'm not talking pages of notes every week or a couple of weeks. It's like, hey, things are on track. Things are off track. What's happening with that project? Okay, here's a couple of notes about what you need from me or what I'm looking from you before the next time that we meet. Just so we don't forget. If you use it as a disciplinary administrative exercise, of course, nobody's incented to take the notes. If you're using it as a reminder of agreements that you've made, like, hey, what am I, as your manager, going to do to, you know, clear these obstacles for you? You want to write that stuff down so you don't forget it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they should be shared with the employee that you're having the one-on-one with?
100%. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah. If the intention is that these one-on-one conversations are helping them be more successful, perform better, more productive, you know, there should be no secrets there.
Yeah, I agree. I think transparency is really important. And, you know, that's what I tell anybody that I meet, there's a new manager that has to do performance reviews. I'm like, your performance review should never be a shock. You know, yep. Every word in your performance review should have already been, happened in conversations with one-on-ones, you know, on a regular basis. If anything is a shock to there's some very poor communication going on that you've got to fix.
Yeah. Well, that said, it happens more often than not.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah. You know, in a typical situation where you have a performance review every, you know, year or twice a year, I've rarely seen them, you know, formally done more than four times a year, which is a lot. You know, the critical feedback of, you know, things are not going well, you know, here the documented feedback there. I've often seen managers soft pedal that, and in their heads, they may think they're being really direct, but the person that's hearing it often doesn't, you know, take it the same way that the manager's thinking about it. So
yeah, and part of that may be around those. I know one of my first management training, they taught us about doing this like compliment sandwich crap, where you're supposed to say something nice, something mean, and end it with something nice. And I'm like, yeah, but if you do that, they only hear the nice. You know, you missed the critical feedback because you didn't I don't know. I tried that for a while, and then I realized that every time I gave critical feedback, nobody received it. You know, they didn't accept it. Yeah. They didn't hear it. And I felt like I had to be more direct and more intentional, not mean or anything, but just, you know, more direct with that kind of communication. And, you know, it is totally something that's hard. It's hard to do, you know, when you're hurting someone's feelings, you know, when they're prideful about their work and you tell them it's like, you know, you did something wrong. Sometimes it can hurt their feelings.
So, well, if you put yourself in the role of a coach rather than a judge, like coach is on your team. And, you know, Michael Jordan of the Bulls had coaches that would give feedback, and you're helping that person get better. You're helping that team win. A judge is assessing whether you did something right or wrong, and they have power and control over you. And it's a different sort of environment and relationship there. Yeah. So if you just put yourself as a manager in a coach seat, then that changes all the interpersonal positioning around things. If you're genuinely trying to help somebody rather than trying to get them out of the organization, you'll operate differently.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of managers aren't taught early on, because, you know, they have to learn the paperwork. They have to learn the basics of management, not necessarily leadership. And, you know, one of the things that kind of flipped a switch in my brain was when your team gets better, you get better. You know, when each individual of your team gets better, the team as a whole gets better. So working with people and honestly going at it to where you want to improve this person's ability to do their job. You want to improve their life. You want to make them happier at work. You want to make them more productive at work, and all those things. If you focus on that and not necessarily the overall, am I hitting my numbers this month? You're going to hit your numbers anyway.
Yeah.
If you're
really stepping back and thinking about the big picture, if you're a manager and you're saying, hey, I have a couple of people on my team that are just not working out, and I need to replace them as soon as possible. You know, where's the trade-off there around, all right, you're going to performance manage that individual, which means take all this formal documentation and then struggle through several months of dealing with that and then working with HR to, you know, separate. And then you've got a vacancy, and then you got to fill the vacancy, and then you've got a, you know, 70% success rate of your new hire that you've got to onboard, and think all the time and energy that's put into changing somebody out.
Yeah.
And then compare that to the time and energy of helping someone get better. And the splash effect, not just on that individual, but on yourself and the rest of the team. You know, does the rest of the team feel more secure and more proud if you're terminating somebody versus if you're helping somebody be successful? So I've seen managers earlier in their experience or without that bigger picture, afraid for their own jobs, afraid that they're missing goals. And then they end up taking a riskier, potentially more damaging action to change people out versus coaching people up.
Yeah, I think one of the worst bosses I've ever had, it was also when I was a relatively new manager. You know, he told me, oh, it's easier just to get rid of somebody, get the right person in there than it is to fix them. And I always thought, well, but how does that make everybody else feel? And, you know, when you really get down to talking to those people, you realize that no one wants to be the weak link. They all want to improve. Everybody wants to get better at what they do. And I think I was Dan Pink had a book called Drive, where he talked about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And mastery was one of those things where you want to get better at what you do. You want to do something that's important, and you want it to get better at that. And when you do that, when you help someone, and some people say, well, I don't have time to focus in on everybody. Well, you don't have to. You can focus on one person until that person gets better, and then move to the next one, and then move to the next one, and do a cycle of just improving everybody.
Yeah. Now, hey, that said, we're in a for-profit organization. You're not operating a social service, and you still have to meet your goals. And there's some people, you know, if you look at that no, willing, and able framework, there's some people that you could help them understand, build the know and the awareness around what you need from them. They could be as willing as heck. You could be working together on skill building, which is the able. But, you know, for whatever reason, it just isn't there. Like maybe that you're managing a manager who's never managed anybody before, or, you know, has a totally different view of the world and, you know, counterproductive headset, or you're asking somebody to be a software engineer and they don't know the programming language at all. So the question is, do you have the time to invest for that person to learn the language, or, you know, work within your architecture? Or is it healthier and better for your organization to change that person out and replace them with somebody else? So yeah. There will be occasions. I think of it more like, if you stole something, if you committed an act of violence, if there's like a significant issue, you just can't work here anymore. Mm-hmm. But performance, you can often help coach people up. And if a manager is continually terminating folks, you probably have an issue with the manager.
Yep, 100%. And one of the things you'll see, if you are that manager that's continually terminating people, you're going to get a reputation where it's going to be hard for you to get people in that want to be there. So how is it, let's say you do have to terminate someone because success isn't in their wheelhouse for whatever role that they're put in. Maybe they're, like you said, a software developer, and they're just not getting the language. Maybe your company shifted, or let's say you build apps, and originally iPhone apps were written in a certain language, and then Apple right. pulled the plug, they changed it, and now you have to learn Swift, and they're not picking it up. They're just not doing it. And you spent, they went to classes, you've done your training, and they're just not performing where they need to perform. How do you go about, pulling the plug? Is it going? I know with many HR groups, you have to go through that, verbal or written performance improvement plan, and then you let them go. Is there a nicer, cleaner, easier way to doing that?
Yeah, there are a couple of different approaches, and there's a phrase that's used often in especially high growth orgs around hire slow, fire fast. Mm-hmm. I agree with the fire fast of you stole something, you committed an act of violence, you did something just totally inappropriate. Then there's no question, right? You don't need to performance manage and give feedback if somebody committed fraud, right? That right. They go tomorrow or today. If someone is on that curve of the no, willing, and able, they know what they need to work on, they're very willing, and they're struggling with the able, how do you deal with that? That's where, if you're having regular one-on-ones, and you're taking a couple of notes around, hey, here's what you're going to do, and here's what I'm going to do for you. And I really, I'm a big fan of the on-track, off-track check-in along the way. And if you have a couple of meetings, whether it's weekly, bi-weekly, whatever, that says off-track, you don't need to have super detailed notes in that one-on-one. It's off-track. You can start talking about to that person about parting ways. I'm a big fan, as hard as it is, of adult conversations. and that means, hey, John, we've been working on this new programming language for 6 weeks. You've completed the course. You've had extra time with somebody else on the team that's experienced. What's not connecting? How can I provide more help? And if somebody is truly willing and they know what you need them to work on, I truly believe in most cases they will build the capability over time.
Yeah.
So if you do need to part ways, I think that adult conversation can be helpful around, hey, it's not working. What's happening? How can I help you? And often I've found, and I've done this with people that have worked for me, where they will say, I'm frustrated. I don't know why I can't get it. The expectations of this job aren't a good fit for me. And you'll find yourself having a conversation about how you can help the person by finding them another job, either inside or outside the organization. And you don't get into this adversarial termination relationship where you need to, buy the person out with a severance package. So that I think is a healthy way to approach it, adult conversations.
Yeah.
A way that I've seen startups and some larger organizations, shortcut through managers that aren't willing to have those adult conversations or don't believe are capable of having the adult conversations. Some companies will offer a no-fault severance package. Hey, if you're leaving us for whatever reason, we'll give you a 4 weeks pay. Sign this release. That's expensive. That lets managers off the hook of being managers and leaders of people. It can reduce your liability. It can reduce your risk anyway. But I'm not a big fan, although I've seen some organizations use it. much bigger fan of just having conversations around how you can help somebody, take a couple of notes along the way, and you know, have an adult conversation if it's not working out.
Yep, I agree 100%. Man, I really appreciate this conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot and I've been able to help me out a little bit as a leader and manager. How can people find out more about you, connect with you, and Series B Consulting, and pick up a copy of your book?
Yeah. Thanks for asking, John. Well, I have a website, scalingforsuccessbook.com. You can pre-order it there. It's out on Amazon, and Columbia University Business School is the publisher. They're offering it as well. It'll be released in July. Mm-hmm. And I also have a executive education program for HR leaders. So again, I've learned a lot of these lessons through making mistakes along the way. And so I'm trying to help other HR people, figure it out sooner with fewer bruises. So People Leader Accelerator is that exec ed program. And I do a bunch of coaching and mentoring for CEOs and HR leaders through a couple of different avenues. But those are two ways to get a little closer to this type of content that hopefully is really practical, makes sense when you hear it, but sadly isn't in play in a lot of organizations today. So trying to touch more people through those means.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to link all that up in the show notes. People can find that at geekleader.com. And Andrew, I really appreciate having you on. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, John.
If you enjoyed that episode, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. I'd greatly appreciate that. And also, don't forget to check out merch. We have some t-shirts that I've designed that are on at geekleader.com. You can click on the merchandise section there and check that out. And also, don't forget about the books from our guests. So if you like this guest and other guests that have written books, please go ahead and check that out at geekleader.com. I would greatly appreciate it, and I'm sure they would too.